This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. So this is the season to weigh candidates' positions and decide where you stand on the issues and who you're going to vote for in November. But the question is, what if our political choices aren't fully our own? What if there's a genetic component to the way we vote, to the sympathies and antipathies that we feel? Many political scientists and biologists and neuroscientists have delved into these questions, and here to discuss their findings is Rose McDermott, political science professor at Brown University and co-editor of the book, Man is by Nature a Political Animal. Rose McDermott, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let me first ask you, when you were in school yourself, when you were in college, when you were in grad school, and you were sort of looking at the way political science had always been done, what was people's common understanding of the way that politics was shaped in an individual person?
Well, certainly when I went to graduate school and when I was in college, the traditional social science understanding was that all of political attitudes and behaviors and preferences were socially determined, you know, that it happened as a result of your upbringing and you learned it at the knees of your parents, and whether or not that came because of your emotional attachment to your parents or your learning in school and in the family, it was really a socially determined phenomenon. And that has been the standard social science understanding of the origins of political preferences for, you know, 50 years or the period of time that this stuff has been looked at seriously.
And when did the sort of chinks in that wall start to come out? You know, when did people start to say, well, maybe it's not just who you're hanging out with, who, what your parents are saying to you, what the people at school are saying to you, what you're seeing on the news? When did people say, maybe there's something beyond this that shapes your behavior?
Well, it's really interesting because there was early work in the 70s that was done in the field of genetics that began to actually put chinks in this armor, but it didn't really translate to the social scientists. So Lyndon Eaves and Hans Eysenck did some work in the 70s that started to show that some percentage of the variance in people's political attitudes and behaviors had a genetic basis or a genetic component. And then there was a famous paper done in 1986, but again, that sort of didn't translate into the social science literature. There wasn't a lot of conversation between the people doing the genetics and the people who were working on politics. And so it's really only been in the last, you know, I'd say 5 to 10 years that the connection has started to be made and the translation happened, so that the work in genetics has really begun to infiltrate and influence our understanding of the origins of political attitudes and beliefs and formations and so on.
And I want to get to the evidence for the genetics of politics in a minute, but I wonder amongst your colleagues or even amongst pure scientists, biologists, neuroscientists, is there now a widespread acceptance of the notion that genetics and politics might be linked, or do you still feel a lot of pushback on that?
Well, I think it probably depends on who you ask. Certainly in the population of people who study behavior genetics, there's not pushback. It would be, you know, pretty accepted that genetics can widely influence all kinds of complex social attitudes and behaviors. But in the social sciences and in political science, I would still say it's the minority that would embrace this notion, and that there still is quite a lot of pushback, particularly among those who study American politics and the origins of ideology, who are quite invested in these notions that it's all socially determined.
Okay, so now how do you go about trying to prove that there's a genetic component to politics? It feels a little bit like trying to prove where somebody's intelligence comes from. There are so many factors inside them and outside them that shape that. How do you start doing this kind of research?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of factors that go into it. And certainly no one would claim that it's only genetics or that it's anything as, you know, simplistic as there is, you know, a gene for. I mean, that's completely ridiculous. I mean, it's really, there's a number of different ways to go about proving it. The early work and certainly continuing work has been founded in classical twin design studies. So these are studies that look at the differences between identical twins, monozygotic twins, and fraternal twins who are dizygotic twins, and the differences in their social attitudes and behaviors. And you can look at it statistically, the difference in what percentage of the variance in let's say, a particular political preference, liberalism to conservatism, can be attributed to a genetic component, which can be attributed to what's considered shared social environment. So that might be your school or your family. And then unique environment would be something that's unique to you as an individual that's not shared by your siblings. So fraternal twins are just like any other sibling set. It's like any other brother and sister, but identical twins really are essentially the same genotype. And so you're able to traction that difference to statistically analyze what percentage falls into these three categories. There's also other kinds of ways to study it that have become available more recently through advanced genetic techniques that allow you to do genetic sampling of people, to look at genome-wide association studies and other kinds of candidate gene studies that actually allow you to analyze the DNA of particular individuals and look at certain outcomes. But those are more recent, and the studies that are not twin design studies that have looked at political attitudes are more recent, and so they haven't been replicated as much. So the classic twin design ones are the ones that go back to the 70s, and those are the ones that we cover in the in a lot of the work that we've been doing recently.
So when you look at identical twins, are you mostly looking at people who were separated at birth and figuring out, okay, what happened to them and how do they vote now?
No, it's both people who are raised together as well as people who are reared separately. And so there's a number of different kinds of studies that are done. And some of them look at people that are reared together, and other studies look at twins that are reared separately. And then other studies look at the comparison between those who are reared together and those who are reared separately. And so it depends on the specific study. And some studies look at certain outcomes like, political attitudes along a broad spectrum of liberalism to conservatism. And others look at things like political participation, how likely you are to vote. And so it also depends on what the particular variable is that you're looking at in trying to explain.
So, okay, now what's the big takeaway from what identical twins tell you? People who have exactly the same genetics versus your average sister and sister, brother and sister, who are, have some genetics in common, but not all of them.
So it's not that you're just looking at genetic identical twins who are genetically identical. You're actually looking at the difference between those who are identical and those who are just regular sibling sets. And when you look at that, as I mentioned, you can traction the percentage of variance that is attributed to genetic components. And with regard to politics, the studies seem to indicate, and there's now quite a number of them, that about half, somewhere between 0.54 and 0.65 of the genetic variance, meaning the difference between people in their broad ideology, again, liberalism to conservatism, not Democrats and liberals, but, really broad spectrum liberal to conservatism, can be attributed to genetic components. So, I think it's fair to say about half in this broad spectrum liberalism to conservatism can be attributed to genetic contributions. It doesn't mean a simple gene, doesn't mean that the environment doesn't matter. It means that, around half of the difference between us has some genetic basis, and it could be many genes contributing to it. It likely is many genes contributing to it, but that's what the systematic, robust nature of many of these studies seem to indicate.
But that's pretty substantial. I mean, you're saying there may be a real serious genetic component to the political inclinations that each one of us feels like, we innately have. I really like this candidate, or I really feel strongly about this position. The genetics are not nothing. They really may play a role here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that that's right. And again, it's not a single gene, right? These genes are, multifactorial, and there's lots of things that contribute. And it probably can, operates through complex cognitive and emotional pathways. It's not simple. But that component appears to be real. It appears to be robust. It shows up in many studies. It shows up across a variety of different forms of analysis. And so, in my opinion, it's real. It's not the only story, but it's a big part of the story. And so if we want to think about the origins of political preferences comprehensively, we need to incorporate this political or genetic component in ways that have been neglected in the social sciences, in the last 50 years or so.
Okay, now let me ask you a few big questions about this. One you sort of touched on. In America, of course, we have Republicans, we have Democrats, but you go around the world and you find all sorts of different parties and leanings out there. So, and our genes couldn't differ too much from people in other countries because most people in America come from other countries originally. So, how would we have a genetic inclination perhaps towards liberalism or conservatism and make that work across the broad spectrum of all the different parties out there in the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we do have some data on that. So some of the studies that have been looking at these broad spectrum differences between liberalism and conservatism actually look at many populations. So it's not just the United States. We have data from, you know, Australia and Denmark and, you know, Sweden and a number of places like England. So there are other countries. It's not just the United States that this data comes from. And it's also not just, you know, 2012. So a lot of this data goes back, 30, 40, 50 years, depending on the particular data set that you're using. And so you can show that the genetic contribution to political attitudes, broadly construed again, really can be shown to be pretty systematic both across populations and across time. What's interesting about that is, again, it's not this kind of you're a Democrat and you're a Republican, but really these very broad, liberal to conservatism. And here I'm talking about, you know, on the right really being fascism and on the left really being communism. And what we understand as a huge divide between Democrats and liberals really being pretty close in the central under, you know, in the center under what would be construed in political philosophy as, you know, classic Lockean liberalism, right? Sort of in the middle. And Democrats and Republicans are both like that because they share certain values around, you know, capitalism and individualism and democracy and all those kinds of things. That doesn't mean that they aren't separate in their policy platforms, but, you know, in a broad world spectrum, they're closer than some other areas. The way that I have come to think about it is that these broad orientations, liberalism to conservatism, don't affect specific attitudes, right? It's not like how do you feel about abortion or how do you feel about capital punishment or how do you feel about immigration. But it really affects these broad, repeated challenges that humans have had over history about how to organize collective life. And, you know, I sort of think about them as falling into several categories. One would be the allocation of resources. How do you take collective resources and divide them among a society where some people produce more and some people need more? Under that category in the modern world in, you know, 2012 in the United States, it might look like welfare policy or healthcare policy, but it's really about how do you think about the distribution or redistribution of resources. Another area would be sex and reproduction, right? How do you find a mate? How do you have children? How do you raise those children successfully? And people have different notions about what's appropriate to do in that regard. In 2012 in the United States, that may look like attitudes toward abortion, toward gay marriage, toward, contraception, toward rape, toward the things that we've seen in the recent discussion. But the underlying issues are really how we feel about regulating sex and reproduction. And the third broad area would really be in-group protection and out-group defense. You know, how do we secure our own in-group from being protected from all kinds of threats, whether it's enemies, whether it's animals, whether it's, you know, the weather, whatever it happens to be. And how do we secure our in-group? So, in 2012 in the United States, that might look like capital punishment or immigration. Out-group defense definitely relates to issues of defense and patriotism and war and the draft and, you know, how you feel about Afghanistan and things like that, you know, the U.S. war in Afghanistan and things like that. The specific attitude will change over time and over place, but these underlying challenges, these underlying constant issues about organizing society around the allocation of resources, around sex and reproduction, around in-group defense, you know, in-group protection and out-group defense, those things will be repeated and will emerge in these kind of underlying preferences toward liberalism or conservatism, broadly construed.
So what you're saying is sort of genes don't change. So the issues that people are thinking about now, if there's a genetic component, has to be in some ways the same kinds of issues we were tackling in 1600 and 1200 and, you know, 500 and 500 BC.
Sure, because that's how, you know, the influence of, you know, the genetic transmission across generations takes place, is how our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and so on solved these repeated problems. Now, in 1200 or 500 or 1500, it might not have looked like, capital punishment, for example, but certainly there were issues related to what to do with members of society who don't fit in. And so there are these underlying challenges, and the particular manifestation of it can change at any given point in time or place. But the underlying challenge remains the same, and that's the piece that I think influences us genetically as we move forward and continue to challenge and deal with these repeated problems that we confront over time and over space.
Okay, so one question that arises for me here then is, if your genes don't really change generation to generation, what happens when you see a generational shift on an issue like, let's say, attitudes towards gay marriage, which you talked about as being a sort of an issue that's related to sex and reproduction and might go back to something genetic? So, for example, when you look at polls of how do you feel about gay marriage, about 63% of young voters say, yep, I'm pretty okay with gay marriage, and 34% of seniors say, I'm okay with gay marriage. Now, that seems like a pretty radical generational shift, but clearly grandchildren and their grandparents share a lot of the same genes. So what's going on?
Absolutely. Well, first, I'd like to go back to one of the things that you said about how genes don't change. That's not exactly what I meant to imply. I mean, you can have genetic drift over time. You can definitely have genetic mutations. You know, that's what diseases arise that way. I mean, it's not that they're immutable, but underlying characteristics can transfer across generations. So I just wanted to be clear about that. The second piece about what you're saying about the difference between grandkids and grandparents, I think has a lot to do with who you select as a mate and who you choose to marry and have children with. And I think that over the last, you know, 40 or 50 years, what you see is increasing assortation. So mates actually finding each other and mating and marrying and having children with people who are politically similar to them. So, you know, in past generations, there may have been other things that were driving marriage to a much higher degree, things like, you know, economic resources or so on. And increasingly, I think you get what happens with a kind of assortative mating where, liberals are marrying liberals, conservatives are marrying conservatives, they're having children. And so you just have increasing polarization of the population across time with, you know, sort of increased assortative mating. And the reason I'm saying that is that if you look at long-term mates, the factor that long-term mates correlate on more than any other factor is political ideology. The only one that comes close is religion, which, you know, sometimes is slightly higher. But religion tends to be one of these birds of a feather flock together, right? You sort of are around people who share your religion. You end up marrying people who share your religion, you know, disproportionately. But that's not true with politics, right? With politics, you're around both liberals and conservatives. So why is it that you're much more likely to marry somebody who shares your political ideology and sustain a long-term relationship with them? And I think it's because you share these values that make it easier to raise your children successfully, to garner social support, to raise your, you know, children successfully. And you build up these networks that then support your values and beliefs on one side or the other. And that increasing sort of, you know, assortative mating over time really can affect populations so that, you know, grandkids, at least on certain issues, may differ from grandparents. That said, it doesn't mean that the environment doesn't matter, right? I mean, again, I'm not saying genes are the only thing that matters. So the environment, education, culture, institutions, all those things contribute, and they interact with genetic factors. And those things are going to influence attitudes across time as well.
When you talk about that kind of mating where people are now choosing people who think like they do, are you saying 40, 50, 60 years ago, people didn't care that much whether the person they were marrying had their same political inclinations, that something somehow just in the last generation or two has really fundamentally shifted?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't know all the complete data on it, but I think that there's bits and pieces that can contribute to our understanding of this. So I think that historically before, say, for example, a high percentage of women were educated and were able to become financially independent, a lot of, men and women would have relationships and marriages that happened through social networks where the trade was basically, you know, the woman would stay home and raise the kids and the husband would, you know, earn the money. And obviously those relationships still exist, but the environments in which they met and so on might have been slightly different. So now in college, when you have 50% or more of undergraduates being women, you know, men and women are meeting in environments, young men and women are meeting in environments where they actually do have political discussions and where, you know, some of the selection from the huge potential pool of people they could marry to the one person that they're going to, you know, have a child with, can actually be negotiated through these political avenues of shared values. So, you know, the sort of just trade of what really matters is, you know, financial things to also having education contribute to the way in which mating takes place has shifted, especially for women in the last 100 years. Certainly a lot more women are getting educated now than were 100 years ago and in different environments.
So if you're looking at a situation in which an executive was marrying a secretary a couple of generations ago, their conversations may not have been about politics, but if two undergraduates meet in a seminar, they're much more likely to have a sense of what the other person thinks.
Absolutely. And I think one of the other things that you see demographically is that, you know, marriage is really becoming bifurcated by class, right? So that rich people sort of get educated and they get married and they have children and they pass their wealth on to their children. So you get this sort of intergenerational transfer of wealth. And poorer populations, what you see is, you know, a higher percentage of people who actually have children, you know, with or without being married and not able to have the kind of wealth that they're going to transfer to their children. You know, to their children in the same way. So, you know, it's almost like marriage becomes a sort of luxury resource of a particular kind of social and economic class, and that can also affect the way that politics gets translated in those environments. I mean, I'm not saying that happens everywhere, but that's an environmental component that contributes to it as well, at least in American culture.
And, you know, you teach at Brown. I wonder if when you look at, you're looking at a lot of young 20-somethings, obviously people who are meeting in college, do you see this way of thinking about things where ideas are maybe valued more highly than other things, borne out in your own experience?
Well, you know, I have to say I've taught at a lot of different institutions. So I'm at Brown now, but I've taught at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I've taught at Cornell. I've taught at Harvard. I've taught at Stanford. And it's very different depending on the kinds of institutions you're in. I mean, the sort of way that mate selection happens is fascinating. And it definitely happens in different ways at different institutions. And, you know, certainly where I am now, I see a lot of you know, associations that I think happen through shared intellectual interest and through ideas and values and beliefs and commitments to particular kinds of, you know, causes or social justice, whether it's, you know, an environmental cause or whether it's a political cause or a social movement or whatever, in ways that, you know, may not be true in other institutions, but I certainly see it here in the undergraduate population. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I just studied all the time. So what did I know?
One question I have for you, just taking a little bit of a veer off the question of mating, is when you know, we're so familiar with looking at the picture of the election map on actual election day, and it's a sea of blue on the coast and a sea of red in the center. And you know what? We talked about that issue of gay marriage, so let's come back to that. On the issue of gay marriage, when you ask people, how do you feel about gay marriage? And you divide it up geographically rather than generationally,
right,
like we did before.
Right.
You'll find, this is the approval ratings, 62% of people in Massachusetts say, yep, I'm on board with gay marriage. 52% of people in Maine, 41% of people in Virginia, 26% of people in Kentucky, and rounding out the list at the bottom is 13% in Mississippi. Now, when you look at that, do you think, well, I mean, it must just be that the people in Mississippi have very different genetics from the people in Massachusetts, or what's going on here?
Yeah, well, again, I sort of go back to this thing where it's not just genes. I think it's genes and environment. But one of the ways in which our genetics, I think, influence us is self-selection, right? It selects, it helps us decide the environments in which we're most comfortable and the groups of people with whom we're most comfortable interacting. And so let's say you go away to college. Where you choose to go away to college is not accidental, right? I mean, it has to do, of course, with the status of the institution and where you get in and how much it costs and, you know, whether or not, you know, it has the kinds of programs you're interested in, but it may also be that you just like that part of the country better, right? And then you may meet people and you decide to stay there or you get a job in a certain environment. And there is an element of self-selection that we move to places where, you know, maybe it's something about the local ecology, the weather that we really like, or the kind of cultural events that are available, or just the community of people that we're really comfortable in. And so people self-select into environments where they're comfortable. They leave places, you know, where they're not so comfortable. And so you know, it's not surprising to me that you get geographic locales where certain ideas are more prevalent than other ideas or certain beliefs or values, because people, you know, they're mobile, right? And they're able to make choices and they're able to have agency about where they go and what they do. It's not like it's all you know, just because there's a genetic contribution doesn't mean that it's deterministic, and it certainly doesn't mean that that means you have no choice over it. It's just part of who you are, along with other things like your background in education and your family background and your unique environment, and so all those things come together. But when I look at geographic distributions like that, I really think a lot about self-selection, and we go into environment, you know, we hang out with people we like and we avoid people we don't like, and it doesn't necessarily mean we punch people in the face if we don't like them, but, you know, we may avoid going to lunch with them, or we may avoid living around them, or whatever it happens to be. And you see phenomenon like gated communities that are just a, you know, physical instantiation of that.
Now, do you think it's possible then that genetic polarization is getting more exaggerated over time? So, for example, somebody who has a liberal inclination moves to Kentucky or Mississippi and they take a job, they get a good job there, and over time they feel like, I don't think that people respect my views and I feel very different from these people, I feel very much on the outside, and over time they look for a job, you know, in San Francisco, somewhere else, somewhere they feel comfortable. So is it possible then that there is going to be over time an actual genetic variation, because people with one inclination move one place and people who don't have that inclination generally stay away?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's definitely possible, and you're more likely to meet and have children with people who are in your geographic vicinity than not. I mean, sometimes you meet people online who are far away and things like that, but usually it's in your environment. And so, you know, in one of the papers that we actually did a simulation, you know, sort of evolutionary simulation of what would happen over time with assortative mating, and you can actually show increased political polarization across time, even in the case of, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years, so that you get increased bifurcation between liberals and conservatives. You know, we didn't look at it geographically. We just looked at it as a percentage of the population overall. But when you do those kinds of evolutionary simulations, it's quite easy to see how, you know, it doesn't take long if there's a certain degree of people who are much more likely to marry and mate with ideologically similar others for the population at large to become more polarized across time.
When is it in a child's life or a young adult's life that they start to, if there is a time, to break out from the influence that their parents have over them in terms of ideology and politics to their own view? Do you see a time in people's lives where they start to maybe express themselves differently from the politics that their parents had?
Yeah, that's a great question. My colleague and co-author, Pete Hitami, has looked at this in pretty extensive way across the lifespan, and shows that it's really when people leave home, right? When they go off, whether or not they go to college, it's when they leave home. So that if you look, and this is again a classical twin design study looking at kids who grow up together, and the shared family environment really drives their attitudes really until the time they're sort of 18 to 25, where you see a radical shift then in people sort of reverting to what you'd think of as their quote-unquote true attitude, or at least a higher percentage of their variance then becomes accounted for by this genetic factor as opposed to the shared environment. So what appears to be happening, or what it looks like is happening, is that when you're in the home, you're really constrained by, you know, your parents' beliefs and your parents' values, and that's what you share and that's what you manifest. And then when you leave home, you know, a much higher percentage of your attitude can be accounted for by genetic factors. Now, obviously, some of your genes are your parents, and now your parents may or may not agree politically. Lots of people have parents who agree. Some people have parents who don't agree. But, you know, these genetic influences aren't just your parents, right? They're your grandparents and your great-grandparents and so on and so forth. And so it's really around that kind of 18 to 25 when kids leave home, whether it's to take a job, whether it's to move out and start their own family, whether it's to go to college, where you really see this radical shift begin to happen. And that's consistent with earlier studies in social psychology that were done, you know, the famous study done at Bennington College by Newcomb, looking at how, you know, most of the girls coming in were pretty conservative. By the time they left, they were pretty liberal. And looking at them 40 years later, they stayed pretty liberal, partly because they stayed embedded in these social networks that were also liberal. So there's this element of, you know, again, self-selection into these environments, reinforcement from these environments, but also, you know, reversion to whatever part of it is accounted for by genetic influence as well.
Do you worry that over time, the fact that there isn't as much genetic mixing, that now people are really looking for people who view things the same way they do, will have impacts not just on politics, but on other issues too, potentially even sort of physical and medical health? Do you see that potentially playing out?
Well, I think it's always something to think about. I mean, you know, the great historical example of this, of course, is the influence of hemophilia on the British, you know, starting actually, you know, through the British royalty that went through all the royalty in Britain, you know, in Europe before the First World War, and most poignantly led to the hemophilia in Alexander and Nicholas and Alexandra's child, Alexa, and, you know, brought about the problems with Rasputin that contributed to the challenges that Russia faced before the First World War. But I think in the United States, what you see is really increasing rates of autism and Asperger's spectrum disorders that especially can be seen as geographically selected for. So, I mean, the rates, for example, of autism in the LA basin have increased incredibly in the last like 20 years. And I think part of that is, you know, probably the result of some degree of assortative mating of people, where one person might not necessarily have that predilection, the other person may not have that predilection, but when you sort of get more than one set of recessive genes together, you can get higher rates of certain kinds of diseases. Now, I'm not saying that's the only contributor. There may be environmental toxins and other things that contribute, but, you know, whenever you see increasing rates of certain kinds of illnesses that have a genetic component, it's something to consider. Now, there's other factors as well, right? I mean, the recent research showing that advanced paternal age contributes to these kinds of things is important too.
Right.
So as people wait longer to have children, they're more likely to have children that, you know, have particular disorders, just like, you know, as moms get older, they're more likely to have kids who have Down syndrome and so on. Not determinative, but just, you know, probabilistically. But whenever you have, increasing rates of recessive genes, you can have things show up that wouldn't ordinarily in random mating. So cystic fibrosis, you know, autism, these other kinds of diseases that have genetic components can certainly be affected by increased rates of mate assortation.
That's fascinating that, you know, that's something that started in a sense with women's liberation and their ability to go to schools has all these unintended consequences about in terms of concentrating ways of thinking or even certain genetic traits inside populations.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, they're huge systems and there's lots of contributing factors. So, you know, again, it's not one simple thing, but it is something that I think about when I look at, you know, different populations of generations, changing the ways that they meet and mate, and how that affects all kinds of downstream consequences, from, you know, social issues like the transfer of wealth to also, you know, literally genetic issues in terms of disease processes.
And finally, a question for you about a real interesting study that is talked about in your book, the idea that there may be people who are sort of alpha people who, instead of contributing to the whole, realize that it's better to benefit from the whole, when we're talking about politics and the people who stand on the inside and the outside. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think that, you know, there's definitely been some studies done around that, and there's different components and different ways you can attack it. But, you know, when you look at democratic systems, one of the things that happens when we have leaders who don't represent us but seem to really represent themselves is that we tend to overthrow them, right? We'll throw them out of office, we'll, you know, take them down. And there can be various forms of it. It can be because there was some kind of, you know, something that they did that was sexually inappropriate that people didn't like, or they stole money. You know, I mean, you can think about the kind of classic ways that our politicians can self-destruct. But in authoritarian cultures and in, you know, countries where they have totalitarian leaders, when you overthrow a leader who's extracting resources for himself, lots of times those people get literally decapitated, right? You can get assassinated. I mean, you think about people who've extracted resources from their society and have exploited their society for their own personal wealth, and sometimes either within their society or from outside, they get killed. You know, Saddam Hussein, you know, Gaddafi. I mean, you can come up with lots and lots of examples of people where when they choose not to represent their constituency, but rather represent themselves, their constituency can turn on them. Now, it doesn't mean that in certain environments we don't select leaders who have that alpha status, because we actually want that person to represent us in intergroup conflict, right? We want strong leaders to help us with out-group defense. And that can happen in that way. We really like them. You know, Winston Churchill in the Second World War, really great. We really want him to represent our interests. And then the minute the war is over and we want conciliation, we don't want somebody like that. You know, we toss him out of office and everybody says, well, how does it happen? Happens because you want different kinds of leaders at different points in time to represent different kinds of interests, which explains why over time you'd have some balance in the population between, you know, a limited number of super alphas and then a higher number of, you know, sort of beta and gamma people who you can think of as foot soldiers.
Right. A really interesting conversation about politics and how our biology could play a role when we vote and where we come down on the ideological spectrum. I've been speaking with Rose McDermott, a political science professor at Brown and co-editor of the book, Man is by Nature a Political Animal. Rose McDermott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3. Hey, Callie.
Kara, we're going to continue our Genius Next Door series with economist Raj Chetty. He's among the four Boston area recipients of the MacArthur Genius Grant.
You know, speaking of genetics, I think the genius to non-genius ratio in this town is kind of off the charts.
It definitely is. That's what makes Boston and New England so rich.
That's
intellectually.
True. Yeah. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.